Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions, the ones that you've left for me in the comments section below on my Q&A videos, or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. You know, if you're new to my channel, welcome. I'm very happy to have you here. And go ahead and check out some of my videos, including my first series on what is wrong with Scientology that I produced almost, a year and a half ago or something, and some of the other more viewed videos like Scientology Organizational Madness and Scientology is Coming Apart at the Seams, and a summary of Scientology and maybe you know, a couple of my longer presentations about it. And you'll get a wealth of information about Scientology in those videos. And then feel free to ask me whatever you want that isn't something that would be, you know, a question that would be already answered by me in some of my other content. So however, on the other hand, I just put up a podcast yesterday, an interview with a therapist, cult therapist, Rachel Bernstein. And this was a really, really fun interview to do. And I will definitely be doing some more work with her in the future for my channel, video work. And that'll be coming in the, you know, in the coming weeks and months. But if you are at all interested in what it takes to get somebody out of a destructive cult, or how to deal with somebody who is in one, if you have family or friends or something like that who's in one, this podcast that we just did has some really, really good information in it, and I can't recommend it enough. So check it out. And now let's get on with your questions. John Mancini, how is it possible to have a job and a life outside of the Church of Scientology and yet still be in? I get it if you live on the premises and your whole life is about the Church of Scientology, but if you live at home and have internet and everything, I don't get how one would be sucked into the thing. Wouldn't you be in a state of cognitive dissonance all the time? Yes, Scientologists are in a state of cognitive dissonance all the time, but that doesn't prevent them from coming up with an answer to that cognitive dissonance of ignoring anything other than what the church or L. Ron Hubbard tells them to say or think or do. That's what being in a destructive cult and being a cult member is all about. It's not like a normal life. It's a life where you have agreed to and become part of a group where the group dynamic is more important to you than your own independent critical thinking. And it's not like a choice is made where now I'm going to be stupid. The choice that's made is I am going to follow the rules of this group, and I'm going to be part of this group, and I'm going to do what this group says because it's offering me something that I feel is worth so much that I'm willing to put up with the restrictions or guidelines or rules of that group. And if you think about it, that's really not very hard to understand because we all do that all the time. You know, in order to drive a car, you agree to follow the rules of the road. You don't like to follow the rules of the road, but you will follow them, especially if a police officer is watching you, because that's the agreement you make in order to continue to have the privilege of driving, let's say in the United States or in the UK or wherever, right? It's not really so dissimilar to that. You simply agree to limit your own personal freedoms and choices. In this case, for example, you're not going to drive 80 miles an hour down a residential road. And you might do that out of common sense, but you also might do that where on days where you're in a hurry and you really want to be barreling down the road, but you're not going to because you know that if you were to do that, you could have that privilege taken away from you. Well, with Scientology, the privilege that they believe that they are getting is personal spiritual immortality. And that's a really big give. I mean, that's the benefit of all benefits. And it's worth sacrifices. It's worth limiting or curbing your ability to go and look at things on the internet that you might be wanting to look at or be tempted to look at, but you stop and you don't do it because you know that by stopping yourself from doing that, you're saving yourself a lot of money because you know that you'll get in a lot of trouble if the church finds out you've been doing that. But you also have a belief and a faith in the Church of Scientology. You think that what it's doing is right and good and pure, and that L. Ron Hubbard actually knew what he was talking about. You've bought into that. And we all buy into things. So if you kind of look at it from that perspective, I think it'll make a bit more sense as to why it is that people who have jobs, have lives outside of the church, and most Scientologists do, are willing to restrict themselves or their behavior or, you know, what they're going to look at or talk about or anything like that. It's not that Martian. It's not that foreign of a concept if you look at it in terms that, you know, relate to your own life. And I think that might, I hope that makes sense. Order 66. David Miscavige, or the Space Pope, as I like to call him, has proven himself to be a potentially dangerous person, imprisoning people, beating his staff, willing to let his own father die. If and when Scientology hits an iceberg and it becomes obvious that the whole thing is going to come down, do you think the Space Pope could possibly decide to take as many people down with him as he can? I don't mean throwing people under the bus. I mean, do you think he could, God forbid, order people to be killed? It's an extremely unpleasant thought, but he is a violent and arrogant guy who is willing to hold on to power by any means necessary, and sometimes I'm genuinely concerned for the safety of outspoken critics such as yourself. Well, thank you for your concern. I definitely appreciate that. I do not think, as a critic of Scientology, that I am taking my life into my hands or that I'm at the risk of actual violence being committed against me by Scientology or by order of David Miscavige or anything like that. I've never had that idea. And of course, I don't, you know, condone or ask for any violence to be committed to Scientologists either. I think violence is no part of, should be no part of the picture. Now, I've been asked a lot. I get a lot of questions coming my way about David Miscavige and will it be a Jonestown and will he have people drinking the Kool-Aid or will he, you know, become, you know, a violent sociopath or something like that. And of course, it's an impossible question to answer because I'm not David Miscavige, I'm not in his head, and I don't know for sure what would happen. I don't have any fortune-telling, you know, prediction powers. But my opinion is no, I don't think that's what's going to happen. I don't think so because I don't think that any Scientologist or any Sea Org member at the Int base, which is where, you know, Miscavige mostly lives, is in a frame of mind where they're going to be willing to commit suicide because David Miscavige tells them to. It's not really like that in Scientology. They're not worshiping David Miscavige. They're in love with or passionate about the concept of Scientology and saving the world. And that's why they make the sacrifices that they make. There's altruism there when it comes to those Sea Org members at that level. Now, they're not saving the world, and they're not doing really any good at all up there, but they think they are. And that's what drives them and keeps them going. And that's why they make the sacrifices that they make. So they're not doing it because they think David Miscavige has the answers to life and the universe. They think David Miscavige represents Scientology. They think that he is the power figure in Scientology who people in Scientology listen to and follow and respect. And so they think, my idea is that those people at the Int base, the Sea Org members there, believe that if David Miscavige wasn't in that position or was taken down or somehow, you know, something bad happened to him, that Scientology would suffer as a result. They think he's the one who's keeping it all together. And they're in a frame of mind that they think they're, you know, lucky to be there and that sort of thing. So I don't think, but they're not in a frame of mind where if David Miscavige says, okay, you know, now you need to go kill somebody or now you need to go kill yourself, they're not going to do that. Now, as far as what would David Miscavige do if the enemy were at the gates and he were about to be led away in handcuffs or something, I think you would see more of a reaction like Saddam Hussein, where he disappears and they eventually find him, you know, shoring up at some hotel or something, like they found Saddam Hussein in some cave somewhere, and he looked horrible, and he was all downtrodden and defeated. I think that's the kind of thing that you would find David Miscavige doing, because he's a cowardly person at heart. He's got a craven personality, you know, as do people like him. So I think that he is not the person who's going to come out guns blazing in a fit of you know, violent, you know, glory. Nobody's going to take me, you coppers. You know, I don't see David Miscavige doing that. I think he's going to run and hide in the bushes or, you know, out the back way or something. And he's going to do everything he can to get away. And I think that I think he'll actually see it coming before the enemy is at the gates, because he's got a whole network of people who have eyes and ears and keep, you know, keep them open to protect him. And I think that that he would have enough warning that he would take off and he would just disappear. And we wouldn't see him or know where he went. And there'd have to be a manhunt in order to find the guy. So that's my idea of what's going to happen there. So that answers actually about 50 questions I've been asked about this. But that's sort of my take on it. Whirlybird. I know that late in his life, Hubbard was in hiding in California, trying to avoid possibly being arrested, indicted. At that point, when he could only look out for himself, burdened further by declining physical health and severe paranoia, did he then give up on appointing a successor? Or do you think that since Scientology had always been more about his amassing a fortune than it had ever been about clearing the planet, that he had never planned on appointing a successor? I don't know if anyone really knows the answer to this question, but since you are so well-versed in this subject, can you offer us your take? Yeah, I've been doing a lot of research and looking into this time period in the 70s and 80s for some research for the book I've been writing and also for other purposes. And so I know more now than I have in the past. So if I say something now that contradicts or seems different from something I've said before, it's because I've learned more about this as I go. And I think that Hubbard was in the frame of mind that he did have a successor when he died. I think he thought that Miscavige had taken over, you know, not taken over in a bad way. Like he knew the church was in good hands. He knew that he had passed the baton to somebody who was running the show, and that was with the CMO, the Commodore's Messenger Organization, that he trusted, you know, literally with his life. He had Pat and Annie Broker there at his ranch in Creston, and I think that he thought they were going to take care of business and deal with his personal things, because I don't think Hubbard was so out of it that he didn't see the end was coming. And as far as Scientology itself, well, he had maintained communication with Miscavige and with international management all the years that he was in hiding. He was not disassociated with what was going on in Scientology. He knew. He had an idea, at least up until, you know, the very end. You know, maybe a month or two or three or something like that, I'm guessing, you know, a few months before he really ended up going. He was kind of keeping his finger in the, you know, in the pies of what was happening. But he knew Miscavige was running things, and he knew that, you know, that international management was established and running and that sort of thing. So I think he thought that things were pretty well in hand when he decided to go. And I think he felt that he had left enough instructions and enough directions on the technical side of things and what to do with various things that he felt like it was going to carry on. And he had written into his will to do various things, which they ended up doing, like getting tax exemption and that sort of thing. So I think he felt Scientology was going to carry on. I think that he was more concerned. Hubbard was more down, you know, dejected about the fact that he hadn't figured out the OT levels. And I don't know what his thinking was in regards to that, but he had to know that he didn't have it all figured out. So I don't know what his plan was in that regard. Chris C. Your recital of the poem, Joy of Creating, reminded me of something I've always wondered. Sorry if it's come up before, but I'm a new subscriber. LRH produced volumes of writings, and the ex-Scientologists I've been exposed to seem to all have an uncanny ability to recall and recite much, if not all, of it. Can you give a specific example of the process one would go through where the end result is having these words forever committed to memory? Was that poem part of a class? How were you introduced to it? What did the exercises consist of? And how would you have performed the steps? Well, nobody actually has asked me about this before, which is why I'm taking it up and answering this, because there actually are a couple procedures in Scientology for memorizing things. Memorization and rote learning is a standard part of a lot of destructive cults and how they inculcate their members or the followers in the teachings of the guru, in this case Hubbard. And so there have been the first and most used in Scientology is something that Hubbard called Chinese school. And this was a procedure that he said or claimed was based on how children in China are taught. Now, I have no idea at all whether this has any grain of truth in it or not, or did in the past. But what Hubbard said is that children in China were taught by having pieces of information put up on boards, and the teacher would take a stick and would point to the board, and the entire class would recite aloud what the teacher was tapping out on the board with the stick. And so they engaged in rote learning and memorization doing this procedure. Well, this is what Hubbard described, and this is what Scientologists do. And especially in the Sea Org or on staff, you will get at musters where they gather up, or at staff meetings, they'll have everybody do this Chinese school, and they'll take butcher paper or blackboards, and they'll write out pieces of information, quotes from L. Ron Hubbard, that they want people to memorize. And they will sit there and chant it, like somebody will stand there, and they will not just chant this like quietly, this is shouted out, like screaming the data. And this is, and everybody does it in unison, right? And so it's kind of impressive, actually, when you get like 100 people in a room all chanting this thing all at once. And then this is done over and over repetitively until the board or the butcher paper can be turned around or rolled back up, and everybody just says it. And this was done with all kinds of information through the years that I was in Scientology. I did this there would be some things that we would do Chinese school on for months. Every morning, we would rattle off management data. Or when I was learning how to be a course supervisor in Scientology, there's a thing called the supervisor's code, which I think is like 23 points or something. And we had to learn every one of them verbatim. And so every morning we would chant off, like we would take a chunk of five of them and we'd go through them. And we'd go through them like three or four times. And over the days we'd go through all 23 points. And you do that for months on end, every morning for, 10, 15 minutes in the morning. After about 4 or 5 months, you've learned it. And I knew that supervisor's code for years and years and years. I could probably right now still rattle off some of those things. So that would be an example of how it was done. There was another time where there was a special project in Los Angeles. I was a manager, and all of the managers for the Western United States were gathered up, and we spent hours and hours Chinese schooling whole issues that Hubbard had written. We had to literally memorize an entire 2-page issue, and that was quite something. That took us weeks to do, but we got it. We got the whole thing, And I don't particularly say that with pride right now. I'm just saying that's what we did. The other thing is familiarity. Is just you hear something over and over and over again. And that Joy of Creating poem that I recited was a case of that. We would Chinese school Joy of Creating sometimes, but also there was just, you just hear it over and over and over again. And Joy of Creating is just a few lines. It was easy to memorize that. So when when you're around something for as many years as most Scientologists are, I was 27 years, and the same important things keep being stressed, then you just learn them, kind of like your favorite songs. You just hear them over and over again, and you pick them up. There now, ever since 1996, there was also a drill that was done in the classrooms with individuals, not Chinese school, but individuals would sit and do these verbatim drills where they were required to learn Scientology pieces of information verbatim. And they were called patter drills. And they were required to learn the patter, like the commands of auditing procedures or what they were expected to say during certain things. And then this was also carried over to learning the code of a supervisor or various lengthy Scientology pieces of information, which I won't even try to get into right now because I'd be talking technical stuff for hours, but long pieces of stuff. And what you do is you literally just sit down in front of a wall and you hold in the piece of paper of what it is you're supposed to learn, and you just sit there and recite it to the wall. You say it out loud to the wall over and over and over, and people will do this for hours until they learn. And then the supervisor will come over and he will check the person. He'll take the paper from them and they will have to sit there and say the whole thing perfectly, not miss a beat, not miss anything. And when they can do that, they get a pass on that drill. Excuse me. And they go on to the next drill, or they go off to whatever else they're going to do. So all Scientologists now do these verbatim patter drills on lots and lots of different things in Scientology. So it is a thing. There are different methods in Scientology to do it. And that's how I knew that poem. Monty Ollie. At about the 12-minute mark, you talk about how Scientologists who have committed crimes should be dealt with in a court of law. Do you believe this to be true for former members like Marty Rathbun or Mike Rinder? They participated in stalking and coercion when they were in, but are different people now? I've said before, I think, that people who come out of Scientology on their own bat have a lot of, they get a lot of props from me. I grant a lot to somebody who manages to overcome the cult thinking process and get themselves out of that cult situation. And I don't particularly hold, massive grudges against people like that. Now, as far as Mike and Marty go, what I'm going to say about them is that they have done so much since they came out to criticize the cult in an effective manner, and they have done this over and over and over again, that at this point in time, my view about Mike and Marty is, how much more are they supposed to do before they get a pass? Now, that's my own viewpoint. I was never personally harmed or stalked or harassed by Mike and Marty, and I understand that there are people out there who have suffered at the hands of what Mike and Marty did when they were in the church. I have expressed before that I hope that Mike and Marty have reached out to them or have done something to, make contact with those kinds of the people that they harmed personally and done something to take responsibility for that. But that's I'm not going to sit in judgment on them, because I feel that they have gone so far above and beyond what most people who leave Scientology do that I don't have a thing on them. Now, that's my opinion. Right or wrong, good or bad, you can judge me however you want to on that, but that's what I think. I do feel that people who come out of a destructive cult situation have amends to do, they have reparations to make. I certainly did, and I to the degree that I'm still doing what I'm doing here, I think part of what I'm doing is making up for some of the damage that I did when I was in the cult, because I did damage to people's lives as a result of being a Scientologist. And I'm regretful of having done that. And so part of what drives me, part of it, not all of it, but part of what drives me to do what I do is wanting to make up for that. I think that's the same thing with Mike and Marty. I think that they are driven to do what they do because they want to make up for some of what, they were involved in when they were in Scientology. And that's about as far as I'm really willing to look at or judge them, because otherwise I think, questions of vindictiveness or, what should be done about them because they committed crimes and they should go to jail. Well, good. Call the police. file a police report or something, because I don't really know what else to say about that. It's this question that goes around in the ex-Scientology community about those two specifically. And I've kind of said what I have to say about it. And that means it's flash answers time.
Order 66. Why do you think the church never lashed out at Saturday Night Live for their brilliant parody of the We Stand Tall video featured in Going Clear? They knew they were being made fun of, and I expected and hoped that the church would respond with some of their usual idiotic press releases. It would have provided SNL with a full season's worth of material. Thank you for your time.
I don't know if the Church of Scientology actually does watch Saturday Night Live or not. Actually, I'm sure that they did know about the parody, and I think maybe in this one case, maybe somebody actually had two gray cells to rub together in regards to the response to that and knew that Saturday Night Live would only continue to ridicule and parody them if they even tried to respond to it. Now, I know that's, you know, a tall order to accept that idea, but I really don't have a better answer.
Ace Ventura. In your answer about spirituality, you talked about a lot of points. I just wanted to know if you still believe in afterlife. With that, I mean recurrent lives, like in Church of Scientology, but also reincarnation without knowing, Eastern.
I actually have no idea. I, again, have a sort of a hope that there will be more life after this body is dead. And I guess if I've thought about it much at all, I've sort of thought of it in terms of, you know, maybe living again in another body, like, you know, continuing life after life. I guess if I had any idea of what I'd like it to be like, I guess that would be it. I certainly don't want to come back as a caterpillar or butterfly or something. I'd like to come back again like this. But that's really, I got very little structure or thought to the whole process of what I think should or could or hopefully will happen after I die. So that's about all I can give you on that.
VSGL. Question for you. I'm finding that your videos and other critics have ads for the Church of Scientology in the beginning. This especially happens when I watch via my smartphone. Is this a Church of Scientology or YouTube thing? I always find it funny that the Church of Scientology is advertising on its critics' videos. Or is it part of an evil plan?
There's no evil plan. The reason that this happens is because I index my videos under Scientology, because it's a topic that I cover in my videos. And so the Church of Scientology has apparently paid something like $8 million to YouTube for advertising. And YouTube's algorithms call for ads to be hooked up with things that are on the subject matter of the ads. So Scientology is pretty specific. So those ads come right to my videos. And frankly, I couldn't be happier about it because it means that some of those advertising dollars are coming my way. So cheers. I've also kind of started to wonder whether maybe some of the people in the advertising department of Scientology are watching some of my videos and maybe learning some things.
Fat Oneful. I've noticed former Sea Org members like yourself grow beards when they get out. Was facial hair banned in Scientology?
No, it's not. There's no restrictions on facial hair whatsoever. And I have just grown this out because somebody suggested that maybe I would look good with a beard, and I gave it a shot, and I agreed. So I've kept it.
Chris Wood. Hey, good video. I kid you not, I mentioned Scientology at my workplace this week, and immediately a guy said that it was insane. So did another coworker. How many in the hierarchy of Scientology know how much of a pathetic joke the public views it as?
Well, I'm not sure in terms of percentages or anything, but I can tell you from my own experience that I knew when I was in Scientology that we had a bad rap and that the media didn't like us and that the public thought that we were kind of odd or quirky, but I didn't understand why. I just thought we got bad press and that there were collusions in the media or there was some sort of a conspiracy or something. I really did think that. And after I got out of Scientology and I got on the internet, and I saw what was out there for real, like I really went down the rabbit hole, everything became clear, and I had no idea how bad it was, how bad the information out there is, and how readily accessible it is, because of course, me being in Scientology and in the Sea Organization, I was denied access to that, and I policed myself when I did have internet access so that I wouldn't look at it. So I did not really have a clue how toxic Scientology actually was when I first got out of Scientology, and it took me months to find out.
Okay, and that's the end of another critical Q&A episode for this week. If you have any other questions or comments for me, leave them in the comment section of my Q&A videos. I'll be happy to look at them, and I try to see every single one that comes in. And also, if you're finding any value in what I'm doing here, of course, you know, consider throwing some support my way or becoming part of my Patreon campaign. The members who sign up and support me on Patreon are really doing me a solid and enable me to do what I'm doing with the content that I'm providing on my channel. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. It means all the difference in the world to my ability to actually do this content and keep it coming out every single week like I'm doing. So thank you very much for that. And thank you very much for watching this show. And I will see you next week.